do with it prohibits disclosure of personal financial information of victims and witnesses to defendants in criminal cases. Also would include verbal representation as a way to commit identity theft. 1535 relating to voluntary intoxication. Why don't I just go to the relating clauses, and if anyone has a question, they can ask, and we can explain it. LC 1536 relating to crime from the Oregon District Attorney's Association has to do with failure to appear. Relation to judicial modification of certain records.
Which is the LC?
This is LC 1537.
Okay.
LC 1538 relating to waivers of youths. LC 1539 relating to domestic violence. LC 1540 relating to driving while under the influence of intoxicants diversion. LC 1649 relating to crime. LC 1194 relating to domestic violence. LC 1680 relating to motor vehicles. LC 989 relating to construction liens. LC 992 relating to contracts. LC 1456 relating to taxation. LC 1875 relating to recreational use of waterways.
1875?
Correct.
Okay. So I've got 1534, 1535, 1536, 1537, 38, 39, 40, 1649, 1194, 1680, 989, 992, 1456, and 1875.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Senator Starr?
Move that we adopt these as committee bills. Or
okay. Senator Starr moves that we adopt as committee bills LC 1534, 1535, 1536, 1537, 1538, 1539, 1540, LC 1649, LC 1194, LC 1680, 989, 992, 1456, and 1875. Is there any discussion regarding bill introduction? If not, any objections to bill introductions? Hearing none. So ordered. So that's out of the way. Now I believe we're going. Any other? Oh, there's one other thing for the committee. There's a tour Friday if you want to go to McLaren. And from 12:30 to 4 p.m. If you'll see Bill Taylor, the judiciary staff, if you're inclined to go. His phone number is 986-1694. So, with that, I think we'll open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 101. Do we have a sign-up sheet, I assume?
Okay.
108. Apparently, I've been admonished I talk rather low, so I'll have to speak up. Sir, if you'll just state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Department of Justice. I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 108, which simply adds to the list of crimes that a sentencing judge can impose a fine for. It adds murder and aggravated murder. Rather surprisingly, crimes ranging from Class C misdemeanors all the way up through Class A felonies have a range of permissible fines, but there is no authorization for a court to fine a person for murder or aggravated murder. We have had a couple of cases, including one in 2002, in which the Court of Appeals has overturned fines that were imposed by judges in murder or aggravated murder cases. What Senate Bill 108 does is simply add to the section of ORS 161.625 that establishes a $300,000 fine for a Class A felony, the language murder or aggravated murder. I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee have any.
Okay, Mr. Fussner, do you have any clue when the $300,000 fine, those numbers were put into statute?
I don't precisely, but I think that those were relatively recent, and I've been engaged in the criminal justice system one way or another since 1975, so relatively recent is truly a relative concept to me. But I think that it was within, say, the last 10 years, because I recall when the maximum fine for a Class A felony was $100,000. It's gone up now to $300,000. And it's true that there are not a whole lot of murderers who can pay $300,000 fines, but there are some who have some money and can pay a fine.
Okay. All right. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that, following up on that question, I was looking down here at subsection 5. When the court imposes a fine for a felony, the court shall make a finding as to the amount of the defendant's gain from the crime. Often you can have someone murdering someone else, and there is no gain other than their joy, I guess, in doing what they're doing. But how is the court going to determine the basis of a fine for someone who commits felony murder? And is it based on the defendant's ability to pay? Because certainly finding someone who has no funds doesn't really get anybody anywhere, and I'm not sure what that does when they get out of prison. So can you expand on that?
Chairman and Senator Walker, I believe that the subsection 5 that you're looking at relates back up to subsection 3 of the statute, and that's a separate provision that allows a court to find that a defendant has profited from a crime and impose an amount up to double that amount.
Okay.
But as I read it, it does not apply to the section that we're engaged in today, which is subsection 1, which simply allows imposition of a flat fine irrespective of any gain. And I might add that the courts are always required to make a finding that the defendant has the ability to pay a fine before imposing the fine. And so in whether it's a murder case or a fourth-degree assault case, the court has to make those findings. And we frequently see that where a court says, well, you know, I'd like to impose a fine of the maximum here, but I realize this defendant cannot pay that much, and I'll instead impose $1,000 or $500. Okay. And they often make provisions to pay these over a period of time that would include after potentially being released on post-prison supervision. It can be made a condition of post-prison supervision that the defendant pay at least a small amount per month toward a fine.
But and as a follow-up question, then, so but clearly the court's not going to impose a fine that someone can't pay on post-release, because then they're just going to end up back in prison.
That's correct.
Okay.
And in fact, there is a separate statute that makes it very clear that if financial circumstances change, for example, someone is on post-prison supervision or on probation, or they've in some other way they are paying off a fine, and then they lose their job, they get injured or something, and they can't pay that much anymore, they can go back into court, and the court's required to lower the amount of the fine to an amount that they can pay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Any other questions? None. We can do a little work session on Senate Bill 108.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move we adopt Senate Bill 108 and send it to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 108 be adopted and sent to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Burdick, do you want to carry the bill? Or
Mr. Chairman, do you want that or do you want to consider?
Yeah, I think.
I'd be happy to carry.
Okay, well, we'll assign you as the carrier. And for the committee, I don't know what Hayfield left consent agenda or not.
Yeah.
Any objections? Okay, Senator Burdick moves that this be Senate Bill 108 be adopted consent agenda. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered, but you'll be the carrier in the event that it's pulled off the consent calendar. There we go. So, Senate Bill 110, public hearing. Mr. Philip Budd. Schradl. That's a danger of being the chair of a committee. You have to butcher people's names right in front of them.
Chairman,
Chairman, as members of the committee, my name is Philip Schradel, special counsel to the Attorney General. And if I may, I'd like to just address Senate Bill 110 very briefly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Last legislative session, House Bill 2348 was enacted and became a statute, and it transferred Board of Parole matters from being reviewed by habeas corpus back to being directly judicially reviewed in the Court of Appeals. And that was enacted at the behest of our office and the court and the Public Defender's Office. And the idea behind that transfer was to eliminate an entire level of review under the habeas corpus statutes. There was a review at the circuit court and then a redundant appellate court review. In House Bill 2348, we made a number of changes, and this bill is intended to simply clarify a drafting error that crept into the process in drafting House Bill 2348 last legislative session. In going to direct judicial review, we put a number of procedures in place to try and make that as streamlined a process as possible. One of those streamlined procedures was to allow a single appellate court judge to deal with motions. In the drafting process, the language that got utilized in House Bill 2348 left it at least unclear as to whether a single appellate court judge could deal with motions for summary affirmance. This bill, Senate Bill 110, clarifies that a motion for summary affirmance can be addressed by a single appellate court judge, either to deny the state's motion for summary affirmance or to grant it when it's unopposed. If it gets opposed by the petitioner, then it goes to a three-judge panel. This bill is simply intended to clarify that process, to streamline the process for the appellate courts, and reduce their expenditure of time that needs to be taken on processing these cases. We encourage this bill because it will help us to a limited extent. We still will need to be filing the motions and still be needing to process the cases through our office, but primarily because it will help the appellate courts deal with these cases in a more expedited fashion. Jim Nass, who is here from the state court, has submitted a letter in support of this bill, too, and I've distributed copies of that along with my written testimony. This truly is just simply a drafting error that crept in last legislative session, and we encourage the Senate Judiciary Committee to pass this measure out with a due pass recommendation. It will save some money, and it will streamline the process. And I'd be happy to address any questions that any of the members of the committee might have.
Okay. Any questions? There are no questions. Thank you very much. And there appears to be no one else signed up. Mr. Nass, thank you for submitting your letter. Work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move to adopt Senate Bill 110 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 110 be adopted and sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And Senator Walker will be the carrier in the event that there's a consent or that's withdrawn from the consent calendar. Senator Walker moves that Senate Bill 110 be added to the consent calendar. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Point of order. Senator Burial.
Mr. Chairman, the discussion we heard yesterday in the Senate floor regarding the consent calendar would indicate that we will have a reading and discussion on every bill.
You will have a reading and introduction by the carrier.
Right. But I can't imagine that if the senator didn't, that if the senator wanted to comment on the bill, he wouldn't just, or she wouldn't just request its removal or call for a caucus off the floor.
Correct. And there is a procedure you can ask that it withdrawn, but it requires three senators to do that. That requires you to read the bill before it gets to the floor. But if you did run into that instance where a problem came up, I think you're right. You
call for a caucus, ask for the support of your caucus members, undoubtedly you'd get it.
And I think you get the consent of most of the members if there was a serious problem. I think suspension of the rules and removal of the calendar, blah, blah, blah.
So I guess just in clarification, Mr. Chairman, I think most of our bills, I just sense a different mood within the body, and most of the bills that get out of committees are probably going to get out, get through the process, I would gather. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered if the consent calendar isn't an idea that maybe really doesn't save much time on the Senate floor.
Well, the only thing it saves, Senator, is that for some reason people will stand up and they go, I didn't plan on speaking on this bill, ever.
Mr. Chairman.
And then things start tumbling out of control.
Absolutely, as you suggest. I guess I would still assume that if the consent calendar shortens the session, it will be by minutes, not by days.
Well, I think that's probably accurate.
And Senator Farioli, we did have the consent calendar in the House last session. I thought it moved much more quickly because the reading clerk reads the bill, and that isn't the way they've chosen to do that over here, so it does take up a little bit more time.
We are a more deliberative body.
That's what I heard.
So. Yeah, okay. Senate Bill 117. Okay. Hearing Jim Lemke. Thank you. As you can tell, we picked most of the real controversial bills to deal with. Mr. Lemke.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Lemke. I'm the Fiscal Services Manager for the Department of Justice. I'm here speaking in support of Senate Bill 117. The Department of Justice is authorized by ORS 180-200 to maintain a client trust account. As currently worded, only monies related to civil enforcement actions can be deposited into this account. Senate Bill 117 would expand the use of the account to also include monies that were recovered or received in criminal cases. Often monies recovered in civil cases can be distributed or must be distributed to a variety of other recipients. Occasionally, it also happens with criminal situations. The client trust account acts as a holding account until the money can be properly distributed. We recently had a situation where there was a seizure of cash, large amount, and the money needed to be deposited. Unfortunately, we could not deposit the money in our client trust account, and so the investigator who had seized the cash, rather than just storing it overnight in the evidence locker, went out and opened a separate bank account so it would be protected. That was kind of a situation that was not the best control of those funds. So Senate Bill 117 would allow us to deposit the money directly into our client trust account. We'd be able to track the funds separately, and by using the client trust account, we would save time and money by not having to maintain a separate account in the state treasury and not have to set up a separate accounting in our statewide accounting system. It would be more cost-effective, timely, and convenient, and it provides the necessary accounting to keep track of both principal and interest, and I would encourage your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions, Council?
I just wanted to, Mr. Lemke, thank you, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mr. Lemke, could you explain just briefly where are these monies going to be coming from? They're not going to be restitution, right? They're not going to be things that would be going to a victim, or is it from forfeitures, or where do you predict that these funds would be coming from?
It can come from any of those sources, Chairman, and
Council Prince.
Okay. I would say that there's oftentimes there are judgments that are given in a court case. It can be in a forfeiture or a variety of those other types of funding sources that would come in through the legal process.
All right. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of one comment or observation. Why has it taken you till the year 2003 to come and ask to change the way the system is running?
Chair Minnis, Senator Walker, we haven't had the situation come up before, quite frankly.
I see.
In this particular case, that kind of prompted us to bring this before you. The cash was in hand, and we had no place legally to put it. And so we said, well, we should take the advantage of the opportunity to fix that.
Well, and we've passed money laundering statutes here recently, too, and I'm not sure that we've had any successful prosecution so far in money laundering, but it's conceivable that you could have a financial operation that is part of the money laundering scheme with forfeiture of assets or something of that nature, I assume. Fines, whatever. Restitution.
Yes.
Okay. I'm happy.
Me too.
Okay. Any other questions? About work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move we adopt Senate Bill 117 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 117 be adopted and sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so order. And Senator Burdick also moves that Senate Bill 117 be added to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? None. Any objections? Hearing none. In order, Senator Burdick will also be the carrier on that bill. In the event that needs to be one. Okay. 123, public hearing. These are like housekeeping bills. You're back.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, good morning again. I'm Jonathan Fussner from the Department of Justice, speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 123. At the present time, when a trial jury is impaneled for a felony case, there are 12 jurors impaneled, and the statute permits up to 6 additional alternate jurors. Those jurors step in and serve if one of the selected jurors becomes ill or otherwise unable to continue with the trial. And if there is no alternate juror available and one of the jurors goes down, usually the result is a mistrial. The case has to be completely retried again at a later date with a new jury at considerable cost in some cases. There is no current authorization for impaneling alternate jurors when the trial is for a misdemeanor, where the juries consist of 6 jurors. And we've had this situation come up a couple of times where a juror is unable to complete serving on a misdemeanor jury, but there's no provision for alternate jurors, so a mistrial has to be declared and the whole case has to be tried over again. Senate Bill 123 would correct this gap and provide that up to 3 additional jurors could be selected in a misdemeanor trial. It does not require selection of alternate jurors. It simply authorizes the trial court to allow it if the trial court chooses to do that. And while it's difficult to judge the financial impact of this, I think that it will have some beneficial effects, particularly in cases where you have out-of-state witnesses or expert witnesses, or where otherwise it's simply going to be a major problem to retry a case. And that does come up sometimes, even in misdemeanor trials. For example, we had the drug recognition expert driving under the influence case, where the state put on a big show. In that case, we brought in experts from all around the United States at great expense to establish that drug recognition expert testimony is scientifically valuable. And if one of the jurors during the trial of that case had become ill, it would have been very expensive to retry that case. So this potentially can save some funds. And it's also particularly significant in cases involving child victims, in which you preferably want to try that case one time and not have to come back again and try it over. I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee may have.
Questions? There are no questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Russell. You guys support this?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That's correct. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I think it's fair to say that criminal trials are predictably unpredictable, and one of the unpredictability is a juror's continued ability to serve. Often in misdemeanor cases, there can be a number of witnesses, or it can be a prolonged trial. Illness can arise, unforeseen circumstances, medical conditions can make a juror unavailable. Sometimes it happens that a juror has an unforeseen conflict. May turn out to have information that they didn't realize, recognize, or know a witness that was unforeseen when the jury examination was taking place through voir dire. So we are supportive of this measure because it reduces, in our opinion, some of the unpredictability in terms of the risk of losing a juror in a trial that takes a number of days. It's our anticipation that with the judicial discretion that this would not be an issue with respect to say, one-day jury trials, but misdemeanor trials that have either complex evidence or a number of witnesses that are gone for many days, sometimes over a weekend, where there's more of a risk for a juror not being able to return.
All right, great. Thank you. Any questions? There are no questions. Work session, Senate Bill 123.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Let's try a new motion. I move that we adopt Senate Bill 123 and send it to the Senate floor on the consent calendar.
Hey. Ah, combined motion. Excellent.
Is that a go?
Yeah, unless the Secretary of the Senate comes running up here and telling us we can't do it. But anyway, Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 123 be sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Sure, if we did that wrong, I'll hear about it.
I think that's dubious because it's two motions, but on the other hand, somebody could just object.
Yeah.
That's
stated. For a divided question.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's correct.
We're saving time.
Procedurally correct. All right, I think that's all of the business before the
planning meeting.
So tomorrow morning, committee is 9 o'clock, 9 to 10. We've got a one-hour presentation. Department of Justice. CSG. It's mental health issues in jails and prisons. So
that goes at 8?
9 o'clock tomorrow. Right. And let me see, is there other?
Yes.
Next week, Monday and Tuesday at 1 o'clock in the House Judiciary, they're having a presentation on what?
It's on the public. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a mapping that we're doing with Ways and Means on the whole public safety process, going from police officers through to treatment at the end. It's something Bill Taylor's been working on a lot with Robin Lamont down there, and it's next Monday, Tuesday at 1 o'clock in Hearing Room F.
All right. So, and if you want to attend that, you can adjust your schedule, see Bill Taylor again. I'd like to be able to have your name plates out if you're going to attend and be a part of the committee. Any further business before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker and Senator Burdick?
You need to also appoint a carrier to Senate Bill 123.
Yeah, I'll carry it.
Okay.
That was your question also. Senator Starr?
Just a little announcement. Mr. Chair, at 3 o'clock today, I'm going to have a video presentation showing a lady educator who was twice nominated for Secretary of the U.S. Department of Education, who's educating minority children in a way that would be very surprising to us all. She's made quite a record for herself. This video will be in Hearing Room C, 3 o'clock, Education Committee.
All right. Great. Thank you very much, Senator. And with that, we're adjourned.